Navy Federal has a mission to put members first by making their financial goals the priority. Receive a lifetime of membership benefits to help you and your family accomplish your life missions, like a full suite of financial products designed to fit your needs, 24/7 live support, and access to over 300 branches on or near military bases. Visit NavyFederal.org for more information. Call 1-888-842-6328 or download the Navy Federal Credit Union app. Message and data rates may apply. All right, glad to have you all here for the first 15 and 60, doing a little bit different format here. Number one, we're going to split this into two parts because we had so many good questions. We really wanted to extend it over two episodes. So this will be today's and Tuesday's episode. And in case you missed the call earlier, we're actually doing a mailbag because it's a little too early to get into some of the stats and stuff. But we do want to continue that tradition of talking about every team, especially early on. Always really fun to do. First, though, we got to talk a little bit of news here. We'll start with the fracas, as Marv would say, on Saturday night. Suspensions abound. I don't really want to go through analyzing the number of games of the suspension. We're just going to say it. There's plenty of other people who are going to talk about that. It's not really very interesting. We got a lot more interesting stuff to discuss. But Brandon Ingram, 4 games for beginning the incident and then escalating it by returning to the fray with a punch. Rondo, 3 games for the punch and also spitting on Chris Paul. And Chris Paul, 2 games for throwing some punches as well. What else we got here?
Well, we should talk a little bit about the age limit reporting by Woj, that the age limit negotiations have hit an impasse. And this is an impasse that is both surprising and unsurprising. The unsurprising part is that the teams are trying to get more from the Players Association. Basically, the big points here are they want medical information and combine participation from everybody who, you know, from everybody. I think it's specifically maybe of the high school jumpers. But the agents in particular are going to fight incredibly hard, and I think we'll basically prevent this from happening if the medical issue is something the teams insist on, because that sets a precedent that agents really like to have that power. And think about how little power players have in the draft process. I mean, they're getting chosen by a team that they have very little control over. They are on that team for at least 4 years if they're drafted in the first round, and then the team has match rights on top of that. And so to basically demand medical information, which is one of the few pieces of leverage that they had, I get why the teams want it, but I also get why the agents and thus the players say hell no.
Yeah, think of how many people would have been stuck on the Kings if they weren't able to deny them their medical information and everyone was forced to show up to the combine. Although there wasn't, at least they're not trying to say everyone has to play 5-on-5 at the combine. Another reason apparently why they're doing 2022 is because there's a class of current American high school freshmen who will have access now to the USA Basketball National Program. And that will also enable the NBA to get more familiar with those guys when they are younger. So hopefully there won't be as much of this, oh, we don't know who these guys are, we can't scout them, blah, blah. More news. We have seen some rest early on in the season. I joked on Twitter, though it's not really even a joke, that, oh yeah, these games really matter. Don't tell me these games don't matter. Look at the excitement early in the season. And then you remember that there's way too many of these games when guys start resting 3 games into the season. And Kawhi Leonard rested. The Raptors won anyway in Washington. And I think that's noteworthy just because of what that tendinopathy was, right? It's kind of an overuse injury. It's a chronic injury. And so they really want to keep it from getting to where it flares up again. And, you know, even when Kawhi came back towards the middle of last year, he was able to get it to the point where he could play okay, but then, you know, it would be sore afterwards. And so I think they really are just trying to avoid any kind of an overload in terms of repetitive stress to it early in the season. And it hasn't really been a minutes restriction. He played plenty of minutes in the first 2 games, but then on the back-to-back they rested him. And same thing with Gordon Hayward. Hayward, I think, you know, because it just wasn't during the season and there was other stuff going on, the significance of that second surgery that he had, we talked about it obviously, but you know, it wasn't something that really was discussed until Zach Lowe's article and that Players Tribune / Athletic video, athletic.com/capspace, by the way, to sign up and give us some credit if you sign up for The Athletic. that, yeah, you know, you have a plate taken out of your ankle. That's another significant invasive surgery. And so Hayward looked much better in that game, I thought, against the Raptors on Friday, which we did for a Twitter NBA show and really enjoy. That was just a wonderful yarn of a game. But so he's resting as well. He appears to be on like a 25-minute limit. They're not even starting him in the second half either to help him be able to close games. We'll just go through some of the rest of the West stuff, and then we'll do the rest of the news for the East in line here. Dirk is out at least through the end of the month with that ankle issue, and it really doesn't even sound like he's doing anything or like starting to practice or anything, so it could be even longer than that, you would think. And then in Memphis, big news, Jamichael Green out for a month with a broken jaw, the second straight home opener where he's had like a four-week injury. They're talking about 4 to 6 weeks for him. And Jaren Jackson Jr. had 24 points in against the Hawks. Isn't that also Danny who he torched for that like ridiculous 8 out of 13 from three game in the first game of Summer League?
I believe it was. Yeah.
So I guess he just like can't miss against the Hawks. But it'll be awesome to see him in the starting lineup, and really good to see that, you know, at this point, four of those top five picks are just going to be starting for their teams. You don't see that all the time. Bagley, ironically enough, the guy on the worst team is the one who's not starting. Maybe the Hawks are the worst team. And the Kings did have a nice win in OKC. They've been quite competitive in two of their three games. All right, you want to get started here talking about the Atlanta Hawks, Danny?
Yeah, let's do it. And again, we're not saying not only we're not going to do records, but we're also not going to do all the rankings because there's no point. Oh, they're blank in offense, they're blank in defense. It's 3-4 games. It doesn't really matter. And
we're also putting 8 minutes on the clock here too.
We're putting 8 minutes on the clock. I don't know if you want to start the clock with the little discussion we're going to have.
Yeah,
on
let's
the game
talk about
they
that game today.
Do you want to include that?
That sounds good. All right, 8 minutes on the clock, and here we go. I'll try to catch it before the annoying buzzer goes off. But you know, sometimes we just need that to curb our worst rambling instincts. So Trae Young, 35 points today against the Cavs in an absolute 133-111 destruction. Also had 11 assists. He just looked great. He got up 14 three-point attempts, made 6 of them, was bombing from deep, really on catch and shoots in particular. I think he's looked pretty good early in the season. He was plus 16 after he had some miserable plus minus numbers in the first two games. And we saw exactly what it was that made us, and particularly me, who had him number 2 on my board, so excited about him, was that once he starts hitting those shots and you have to double team him, so much more opens up, right? And the Cavs, you know, have plenty of experience playing against Steph Curry, but they apparently forgot all about that or just didn't take Young that seriously. So once he started hitting, then he was able to get the assist work going. And I think he's actually, you know, if you're going to compare him to Steph again, a much more natural passer than Steph. And I thought that some of the things that looked really good for him were getting into the lane, rising up, and then being able to drop the pass off to the big at the last moment. It looked really good. We'll, of course, have much, much more on Young once we get some more tape on him. But this is a really, really encouraging game for him. He just absolutely killed Colin Sexton. And then a few other notes here. The transition D for the Hawks was not good. They really struggled matching up in transition, but Cleveland just wasn't able to run quite that much after the first quarter. The Hawks actually trailed by 15 in the first quarter, and it looked like it was going to be another miserable blowout. They also just have nothing at the four right now with John Collins out. And, you know, they're starting Vince Carter. He can't rebound or protect the rim at all. He's just basically a standstill shooter at this point. Then they're bringing in Amari Spellman, who actually has had some moments in this game, but, you know, he's not a three-point shooter either. Or I'm sorry, he's not really a four either. I thought Torian Prince continues to look good, finishing at the rim. His ball skills, he was able to blow by guys on switches a few times. Kevin Huerter, really my first chance seeing much of him. I liked his ball handling ability in transition, liked the fact that he took some threes off the dribble. And on offense, I was actually impressed with his mobility and athleticism and his ball handling. You know, he's more, I think, you know, in terms of that stuff than like just a straight Kyle Korver type. But he really struggled on D. He's a very upright player. He's more of a straight line up and down athlete than being able to sit down into a stance. And he really doesn't get deep enough in his stance either. He's just very statuesque defensively. DeAndre Bembry's three-pointer looks really good right now. They even ran a play for him to come off a screen and shoot a three. And so he was able to make 3 out of 4. Spellman was 4 of 5 from three as well, as the Hawks were 22 out of 47 from downtown in this game. So that's all I had there. Do you want to get into the questions?
Yeah, we can do that. One thing I'll mention is I really enjoyed watching Young and Herder play together. And offensively, defensively, they're going to be real problematic for a while. But offensively, like, Herder's a logical beneficiary of the attention Trae Young's going to get when he's hot. And there was one big play late where it was the ball pinged twice, I think, to Herder. He had a three that effectively ended the game. And the ability that Herder has to handle the ball could be useful. And that actually ties in with the first question that we'll do. And we'll see how many questions we can get to, which is, what free agents could or should the Hawks reasonably get for next year? And
you're going to start by saying how much space they're going to have.
Yeah. So they'll have about, you know, 38, 40 million in space, depending on where their draft picks end up, because they're not only getting their own, but they have that protected pick from Dallas that they might be getting. And so one of the big things they have to do this year is figure out what they need most, what they need. And fortunately for them, I think they can go in a lot of different directions. I don't know whether John Collins is a 4 or a 5. I also don't know if he's good enough to preclude you from signing somebody at either position. Torian Prince, I think, can be a part of it, but you can figure out what his ideal role is too. So what I would be looking at as one of the more important things, I mean, sure, it'd be great if you could get a really capable scorer, but somebody who can help give you a defensive identity on the interior would be a great thing. And because you could draft that guy too, but I think identifying, because the center talent's going to be available this year, you can maybe try to find somebody there. And then a big target would be finding, if it's not Herder, a logical backcourt partner for Trae Young.
Yeah, backup center as well. I mean, someone to be what they're hoping Lynn would be. Lynn was awful today, by the way. He does not look good coming off that torn patellar tendon. That remains one of the just weirdest moves of the offseason, was taking him into cap space so you could pay him $13 million this year. But here's some of the names that come to mind for me. You know, I think you want to go Young, obviously, some restricted free agents. I think TJ McConnell is someone who could be a really good long-term fit as a backup point guard behind Young. He also just kind of does some of the things that Young doesn't. You know, he's tough, he's scrappy, and he'll be an unrestricted free agent as well. I mean, there are so many point guards on the market. It's crazy. Spencer Dinwiddie is a name, certainly, that would come to mind as well. Corey Joseph will be a free agent. He's a guy, again, who provides some of that toughness that maybe Young is not going to have, and he's also has experience playing in two point guard lineups. Patrick Beverley maybe would be an older option if they decide they really want to, you know, try and take a step forward next year. We'll see what they look like at the end of the year. DeLon Wright also kind of falls into that category for me. They're not going to be in the mix for the top free agents, obviously. Maybe Malcolm Brogdon is another one. I assume Brogdon is going to turn down the biggest extension that he can get, which, you know, I'm not sure if that's a great idea. We'll see what kind of a season he ends up having. He is definitely older, but there are a lot of options at point guards. I mean, Tomas Satoransky is another one, you know, who could be a good player on this team. We didn't even mention Terry Rozier as well. So a lot of good guys. And then I think at center is another one, some younger guys more on the restricted side. Jordan Bell, Willie Cauley-Stein, Maxi Kleba is someone who I think could really help them as a, you know, kind of a switch center, can hit some threes. You mentioned we don't know whether Collins is a 4 or 5. I think they really need to answer that question this year. And if he is, and I think they need a 4 regardless of whether he's a 4 or 5, because they don't really have anyone else like that on the roster as well. But I think that's pretty good. Let's see how much time we have left here. All right, we got a minute 20. You want to do another one of these real quick? Will Torian Prince be the Hawks' best player this year?
Game in, game out, I think he will be. Because Collins is such a dependent player, and I think Prince could do a little more with the ball in his hands, and Trae Young is going to be incredibly up and down, and so I think Prince can be their best player this year.
Trae Young might be the most inconsistent player in the whole NBA this season. And then early thoughts on Lloyd Pierce. You know, I think a lot of it's going to be development. He's certainly empowered the young players early, in part due to some of the injuries that they've had, but even the guys who are out, you know, they'll probably look better with Dwayne Dedmon back as well. As I mentioned, I didn't really care for their transition defense, but they're doing a lot of stuff, I think, to make life easier for Young. I like the fact that he's just putting the ball in Trae Young's hands and letting him go to work as, you know, a 19, 20-year-old point guard. And they're doing some decent stuff to get him going. And when he was hot, they really ran some nice stuff. The players themselves really actually ran it, which is good. Again, he's empowering them, where, you know, they had Young give the ball up and then come off that screen at the top of the key, the Kyle Korver screen, I call it, where the Hawks are really the first one to run that, where they would send it to the wing and then have a big screen away for a shooter. And we are done. Okay. Before we get to Boston, This from TripAction. I've been booking a lot of travel for myself lately. And if you're booking a lot of business travel, it's pretty outdated at this point. It's really time consuming. But TripAction takes the pain out of corporate travel management with a complete solution that helps businesses save and keeps employees happy. You don't want to send your employees routed through Pierre, South Dakota every single time. Is that the most obscure state capital, you think, Danny? Pierre, South Dakota? Maybe Jefferson City, Missouri?
Bismarck?
Bismarck, I think, is the biggest city in North Dakota, though. It's like the ones I think of, obscure are the ones that are just like have no other purpose other than being a state capital and just like in some random location. Like
you might have sold it for you.
Well, TripAction won't take you to any of those obscure state capitals unless you're got that as your end destination, of course, with easy booking from desktop or app, 24/7 proactive around-the-globe support, and incentives for employees to save on travel expenses. That's always good, too. Companies large and small see over 90% adoption and up to 34% savings on travel when they use TripActions. No wonder companies like Lyft and Sara Lee's Frozen Bakery trust TripActions with their business travel. Learn how it can reshape business travel at your company today. You'll be rewarded just for checking them out. Go to tripactions.com/capspace, attend a 30-minute demo, and you'll get a $100 Amazon gift card just for watching that demo. Hurry, this offer is valid during this month only. That's tripactions.com/capspace. Easy to remember, /capspace, because we talk about it all the time on the program. For a free demo and a $100 Amazon gift card, tripactions.com/capspace. Let me know that /capspace URL that you came from us. All right, what we got for the Boston Celtics? We'll do one like main question, and then we'll do like a lightning round at the end here.
So the main question we're going to do is, do you think the Celtics will get under the luxury tax this season? And how, if so? The Celtics, as a point of reference, are almost exactly $3 million over the tax line as of right now. And I think the first place to start here is shouldn't they? And for me, the answer is more so than almost any other team, they should. And the reason why is because of the prospect of the repeater tax in a couple of years. And while Boston's tax bill this year would not be prohibitive, remember, that's adding a dollar for dollar in a year that this team might be crazy expensive. They want to retain Kyrie Irving. They presumably want to retain Al Horford. Tatum and Brown will be on big money new deals at that point. Terry Rozier, if he's still around, will be too. So to get under for $3 million, one way to do it would be involving Terry Rozier. His money actually squares it pretty cleanly. But I think if they were to trade Terry Rozier, they would want immediate contributors. So the way I would do it would be unloading Yabusele and Jabari Bird. I don't know the complications because I've just never dug into it about if the really disturbing allegations against Brown if something happens there with Jabari Bird, what they can do in terms of getting out of that contract. But either way, $3 million is not that much for them to get off of. And they could do it with those two guys. And they would actually still have about $1 million if they did those two moves to get somebody at the absolute minimum, maybe prorated later on in the year, and then they would be able to make it work.
Yeah, Yabusele, you could see certainly just either some sort of a trade being made that he would be involved with, or they wouldn't take back much. You know, he's not in the rotation. He is very unlikely to contribute anytime soon. And maybe you could see them moving someone like Semi Ojeleye as a sweetener as well. You know, if Ojeleye just is not going to be in the rotation. I like Ojeleye, but yeah.
They also have a ton of picks. True. Yeah. I mean, they could just throw any number of things in there.
One thought is, I think if they were to move Rozier, that if they did that trade, they would want to find a way to also unload other salary and get below the tax. But the salary matching becomes difficult when you've just got Rozier and some of these other small salaries. You probably would need to get Marcus Morris involved there. But Marcus Morris, you know, actually is going to contribute. And they've said, hey, you know, this is a championship contender. It's really tough sell. Even if I completely agree with you that it is smart for them to get under the tax. This isn't like Denver, where like Denver fans are telling me, oh yeah, like, but the repeater tax, it's like they've never paid the tax. Like, they're so far away from being in the tax 4 out of 5 years. But this team, you know, with all the talent that they have and the need to pay them, they absolutely are gonna be in the tax. So it is a much more valid concern when you're so close to it that you might be able to get out. And really, you know, maybe you could say that Marcus Smart could be in a trade once he's eligible on January 15th, because you signed with full bird rights. It's January 15th versus December 15th if you're just signed as a free agent. So it is a little bit difficult because, you know, Aaron Baines is another one. He can block a trade, though. So a lot of their salary, it's really tough to move here. And So you wonder if and how they could do it. I mean, if I had to make a guess, and also remember that there's some teams with trade exceptions that could probably fit Yabusele. But, you know, what is the price, right? This Boston team, I don't know how many good seconds they have available, but, like, is anybody interested in, you know, the number 59 pick in the draft because this team's going to be good? And maybe not. And, you know, giving up one of their firsts seems pretty rough. And so maybe what the structure could be, again, is, all right, a way to offload a little bit of dead salary. Maybe you could include more in there as well and get back someone who could contribute on the level potentially of a Morris. But even that is like, all right, so someone who makes $3 million and now but can be as good as Marcus Morris, there's not that many of those guys either. And if you're going to give up a first round pick to get someone like that, you know, even if it's their own first round pick, that becomes hard. So I predict they will find a way to do it, but it's not as easy as you might think.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And they have their own seconds moving forward, but they do not have any extra seconds. So maybe it could be a circumstance where they give up a first and then the other team gives them their second. So like it's a net move down, something like that. One of those kind of creative moves. But we can get into, this one will be a little longer than a lightning round. Somebody asked if I still see Jason Tatum as a potential complimentary star. And the answer is yes, because while Tatum has a wonderfully diverse offensive game and is more capable defensively, I think we talked about this on the Twitter NBA show we did, that he's not a dominant defender, and anyone right now who thinks that he is mistaken. But I don't trust him to be the linchpin of a successful offense or to be the linchpin of a successful defense. And so generally for me, if somebody is neither of those two things, they're a complimentary star. You can still be an all-star, you can still be a Hall of Fame player without hitting that. But if you're not that guy, it's just something different. It doesn't have to be a lot worse. I mean, I would say to DeMar DeRozan is a complimentary star. And yeah. I mean, I'm not saying Jason Tatum could be better than DeMar DeRozan.
If you're not a top 15 or maybe even top 10 player in the league, you're probably, I mean, you know, because we talk so much about, you know, championships on this program. And so, yeah, I mean, I think, you know, a lot of it complimentary is, you know, what do you mean by complimentary? So, yeah, I see your point there, to be sure. You know, is it impossible that he could get to be, you know, a top 10 player in the league? It's not impossible, but.
Oh, he absolutely could.
I mean, you're probably smart betting against anyone getting to that level, unless it's, you know, LeBron James coming out of high school or something.
Do we have enough time for the other lightning round question?
Let me just a little bit more on that too. I know this was specifically about your opinion, but sure. I'll give my own too, that you know, I don't see Tatum as a guy who draws a lot of help and really is going to have the type of game to set up others, right? He's a mid-range assassin. He's a scorer. But is he the kind of guy who's going to get the sort of penetration or be the kind of pick-and-roll operator where he gets in the lane, forces help, finds other guys, can average a lot of assists? You know, I mean, really the best creators in the NBA now are capable of doing that, you know? And Tatum has shown some passing chops on occasion. But, you know, his first instinct in life is to get to a mid-range jumper. And he's already very effective at that shot, more effective than I thought maybe he'd ever be in his career. And he's already there now, you know, when he was coming out of the draft. And his three-pointer looks really good too, good in transition, et cetera. But, you know, I'm just not sure that he is like, all right, we're going to give it to this guy and he's just going to set other guys up. You know, he's kind of more of an ISO guy. And that's a very valuable player, but he's also, it's harder for that guy to be the foundation of a really efficient offense, the number one star and scorer. But he's in a great situation in Boston right now. Let's see how much time we have left. 30 seconds. Rather keep Rozier or Smart for the long term?
In the abstract, Rozier, but I'm guessing he's going to get a lot of money on his next contract. So if he gets, you know, let's say $18 million a year or something like that, then I would rather have Smart at his price than
Rozier. Yeah, and he's just more versatile than Rozier defensively. You know, and especially when you consider that he's cheaper and he can guard more positions. I agree. I probably would rather have Smart, even if Rozier is probably a better player. All right, let's move on. We made it out 5 seconds before the buzzer. Brooklyn Nets.
This is a question that we get asked in various contexts, but is it more important for the Nets' future that they improve their win total and try for the playoffs to lure a free agent, or would they be better off getting a blue chip talent in the draft? And they are among the many teams to me that would benefit from playing this by ear. So if they're close enough to really, I mean, the playoffs in the East might be high 30s, it might be low 40s, but if they can be in that mix in January, then I think they keep pushing forward. But if they're not, if they're clearly behind pace, then you start to retool. And so you use this beginning part of the year to assess where you are and also test out the trade market to see really what a sell-off would look like, because you need to know what the alternatives are.
Yeah, I think that's right. And, you know, they have had some guys who've looked good in the early going. Caris LeVert looks better than we thought he would. Now, you know, that could be 3 games, but I think his shiftiness off the dribble, I think, is something that's going to continue to look pretty good. Dinwiddie has looked all right. Russell, you know, okay. I thought it was noteworthy that he was in the game in total garbage time against the Pacers last night. Ultimately, though, I don't think it's realistic for them to lure a free agent.
I'll phrase it differently. I don't think it's likely that winning a couple extra games this year makes the difference.
Yeah.
If they're going to get somebody, it's somebody who has a connection with the franchise that we don't really know yet, and they're not going to be sitting there going, oh, they won 38 games instead of 32. That's why I need to go there.
Yeah, that's another thing too. And there's just, to really have guys at the top of the market, it just seems very unlikely that two guys are, I mean, they have the space, but like that two players are going to go there and really transform them and get them back into the playoffs. I mean, that doesn't seem incredibly likely to me. And then that one guy is going to go there also seems pretty unlikely to me. You know, no matter how good they look this year, that one guy is not going to put them in a championship contention very likely. So they still don't have that one awesome guy, though. Again, LeVert, you know, might be starting to change my mind on that a little bit. And so they got to still get more high-end talent on this team. The best way to do this is in the draft, especially when you say getting a blue-chip talent in the draft. If we're saying, like, okay, it's assumed that they're going to get a blue-chip talent in the draft versus maybe they would get more respectable and maybe lower free agent, then, all right, now it's really a no-brainer to me. But, you know, I fear that they're just going to kind of end up drafting 10th again and or not again, because they never have their pick, but they'll end up drafting 10th. And you know, they've done a pretty good job. I mean, I was thinking about it during the Pacers broadcast, actually was talking about this, how they got LeVert for taking on Andrew Nicholson and trading away Bogdanovich, who then of course was playing for the Pacers. I'm sorry, they got LeVert for trading away Thaddeus Young, and then they got Jared Allen for the Bogdanovich Nicholson salary dump, and both those guys are now on the Pacers. But Jared Allen and Caris LeVert looking like two damn good picks for 20 and 22, so they've done a solid job. Rody Kurek looks good, although he suffered a sprained ankle late in that game on Saturday against the Pacers. So they've done a solid job of finding talent late in the draft, but hopefully they'll get a chance to apply that to early in the draft. Any other thoughts there?
And I think that that leads into one of the lightning round questions I wanted to talk about, which is, which of the players on the Nets has the most potential? They asked Russell, LeVert, or Allen. I think we can expand it if there's somebody else that you feel does it. And it's interesting between LeVert and Allen. I think for me right now, those are the two guys that I'm talking about, just because LeVert has shown a lot more burst. He's just more explosive to me as an offensive player. And it's not like D'Angelo Russell is a great defender. Jared Allen, I see him more as like maybe an above average center, starting center, which is intensely valuable. But I think I'd probably go in terms of ceiling. I think I'd probably go Caris LeVert.
And you know what? It's funny. I mean, you always say, oh, don't overreact to three games, right? Like, but just it's not that he's scored, you know, I think he's been over 20 points each of the first three games. It's not that he's scored these points and had efficient games. It's just that he's looked good. He's created separation. He's beat good defenders. He was being guarded by Victor Oladipo, and quite a few times with excellent footwork was able to wrong foot Oladipo. He had a beautiful player. He came to the lane and then pivoted back over his shoulder. He just totally blew by Oladipo on a closeout as well. It's more just about how he's looked than, you know, okay, he's gotten hot shooting the ball or something like that. So I think my opinion, yes, he's the highest, especially because Allen, you know, just is always going to have pretty limited ball skills. Centers are less valuable in general. I know you said intensely valuable. I would moderate that to valuable just because replacement level at center is so high. KP has done some great work on that when he was talking about the draft last year. So LeVert would be at Russell. He's just too slow for me. So I just don't see his potential as being high enough. I might even put Dinwiddie as having higher potential than Russell. And I was, when we're talking about point guards, this is another thing actually that KP did some research on, but there's an article by Baxter Holmes about Steph Curry, that point guards generally will have their best offensive seasons at 29, although then they drop off very quickly after that, but they peak later than most other positions do. So you can see, and we're seeing that with like Kemba Walker now too. He's has been awesome the first three games of the season. We'll see if that continues. A lot of that's been from three, but I think that's it. All right, we got 2 minutes left here. Which of these last two questions you want to do?
I like the question of should the Nets pay Russell or Dinwiddie? And my answer as of right now might be neither. The real lawyer answer is it depends on how much each guy gets offered. I mean, yeah.
Dinwiddie has a minimum cap hold, and Russell has a $20 million cap hold. Yeah. So that's a big part of it too.
And Dinwiddie, I can see, because he doesn't have the blue chip reputation, it's more likely that he falls through the cracks of free agency than Russell, because somebody's going to see stars in their eyes because of what Russell was. And there's a reason why he was drafted as high, you know, drafted number two overall. So, or was he was three. Jahlil was, I can't remember anymore. But I think they need to look for a real long-term answer that makes sense with their core. And there's a significant chance that both those guys get overpaid, or that spending on either of them takes the Nets out of the 2020 Derby, which might actually be their best chance at really getting good free agents.
All right, let's move on to the Hornets. To whom would you give a majority of the shooting guard minutes to for the Charlotte Hornets? And so who are our options here? I mean, I think we could talk about their wing rotation. We're going to talk about that actually for the Heat with Liam, who is really interesting. But, you know, some of the guys they have, they've got Tony Parker, whom they've played some in two-point guard lineups. Jeremy Lamb is starting for them right now. They got Malik Monk as well. He played 34 minutes the other night against the Bucks. You know,
and we should mention Nick Batum, because he was the starting two guard last year for this team, though he shouldn't be the two guard for this team this year.
Yeah, no, it looks like Batum is probably going to be really at small four. And then Miles Bridges is in that mix. Dwayne Bacon, in theory, although he probably shouldn't play at all based on what he's shown in his career as kind of a ball-dominant guy who doesn't shoot any threes and isn't efficient. So, it's interesting. I mean, they actually have some options. Monk has looked solid. I think Lamb, though, is the best two-way option. Also has some pretty good ball skills. So I think him starting makes sense. Monk is, you know, really a Lou Williams type of sixth man, in theory, if he can get there. Don't really care for Tony Parker at the two at all, just with his lack of shooting. And they have, you know, between Monk, Lamb, Batum, they've got enough other guys who can handle the ball on the perimeter that having Parker out there with another point guard just doesn't really make sense. I think he should just be more of a straight backup role. I mean, I think they're trying to find ways, because he's this marquee signing, they're trying to find ways to play him more. But, you know, I don't really see him being particularly effective, just as he wasn't really in San Antonio last year. So anything you would add to that?
I would say when you have Kemba starting, and Batum can make passes and decisions, though he's not as dynamic physically as he has been earlier in his career, you don't need as much of what Malik Monk brings. Sure, his ability to catch and shoot is valuable, and if Lamb continues to struggle as a shooter, then this starts to change the calculus a little bit, but I would rather have a little bit more size there, especially now that they're bringing MKG off the bench. So I think Lamb is a more cohesive fit with it. Now, if they move Kemba Walker, then you probably bring Malik Monk into the starting lineup to give you a more dynamic ball handler to complement whoever is the other point, the other guard in the starting lineup.
Hornets have actually looked pretty good early. In fact,
they have.
The Heat almost came back on them the other day, but they had a nice lead there, just completely destroyed the Magic. I mean, that's going to be one of the worst offensive games all year, that Magic game in Charlotte. All right, we got about 4 minutes left here. Where do you want to go next?
I want you to answer this, because I've been struggling with it since we saw it in the prompt. What is a reasonable return for Kemba Walker in a trade right now?
Oh, well, there's always a couple of components to this, right? Like, if they continue to play well this year, then it takes a lot, right? Because you're not going to like gut this team that's going to be in the playoffs. But if you just say in a vacuum, he's on the market, what would be fair? Oh, that's tough. I think a low lottery pick, you know, might be something that you could look at. And then, you know, another player who is, you know, a solid player on a decent contract. You know, especially if you're talking about him probably getting traded at the deadline, which you would imagine it's not going to be much before that if it does happen. You know, I mean, we've seen, for example, to just think of the Paul George trade, you know, Kemba's not at the level that Paul George was at when he was traded. That seemed like a very low return based on what typically has been there. I think Jimmy Butler is an interesting analog as well, right? They're talking about Josh Richardson, a good young player on a good contract. Presumably, if the Hornets move Walker, they would be in more of a rebuilding mode. The Wolves are trying to get something that's more, you know, to continue to help this year with you know, Tom Thibodeau not exactly looking towards the future at the moment with his job in jeopardy after this year, in theory. You know, you could look at then for just a regular start, because it's like Kemba is kind of below a superstar, but, and, you know, I think he should get more than, say, Eric Bledsoe did last year, even though Bledsoe had 2 years on his contract. And that Bledsoe was essentially just, you know, a protected pick that was protected to be out of the lottery, essentially, for at least a couple of years. So, you know, I'm thinking like something around the 10th pick, the 8th pick, something like that, you know, in terms of value, but that's or, you know, a top 8 protected pick, a top 6 protected pick, something along those lines. But, you know, who has that type of a pick, right? Who is presumably going to get traded to a contender. And then you're like, all right, you know, what are you going to find there? The teams that have, the only good team that has a lottery pick going forward really is the Celtics. And, you know, they don't have no need for Kemba Walker whatsoever. So it's going to be hard to find a deal for sure that's going to really give them the type of future assets that they want. You know, I mean, maybe if it's Phoenix, but, you know, Phoenix isn't going to be in the playoff mix. So, you know, you could have like, yeah.
Well, and that ties in with the other thing I wanted to say is there's also the complication of whether the team is treating him as a rental or whether they're getting value with his bird rights. Yeah. Because that would be the ideal, would be a team that could benefit from him this year and has his bird rights. But there just aren't that many teams on that list. Like, you know, there's a possibility that New York would be interested in the abstract, but they have no reason for it to get him this year. They could get him in free agency. The Lakers, similarly, like maybe they would give up something yeah. small. He would definitely help them. He would help them a lot, but they also have Lonzo yeah, and everything else.
Maybe
so.
Like a, you know, Pacer, like if Turner hadn't been extended, the Pacers for Miles Turner, you know, like that could have been like that sort of a, you know, a good young starter.
That would have been so much fun too. Oh man, yeah. Kemba and Oladipo together.
Yeah, but that's the sort of thing. Maybe there's someone who's going into restricted free agency because, you know, this team is going to have to pay Kemba too. That also really reduces his value. All right, we went over for the first time. Excellent. The trade will get us there. Chicago Bulls, you had a few news items here to discuss with them. Denzel Valentine remains out with that left ankle injury. It was the initial timetable was 1 to 2 weeks. Then it was discovered that he has a bone bruise, apparently recently, or at the very least, it was publicized that he has a bone bruise. And this is the third big left ankle sprain that he's had in his career now. And he's not even going to be reevaluated for 2 more weeks. So that's not good. And then we actually speculated on this when Shaq Harrison was waived right at the start of the season, that the Bulls would be a great fit for him. They have in fact signed him. They are going to waive Omer Asik. Be interesting to see whether Asik gets stretched. He's owed $3 million for next year. They have to decide within 48 hours of waiving him. But it's also possible that, you know, they could get a long-term injury exclusion for him, whether they stretch him or not, because of the complications with his Crohn disease and arthritis. He hasn't really been with the team. He hasn't been playing at all. So anything else before we get to the questions on these guys?
Well, I'm happy that Shaq Harrison's going to be on their team. They needed another point guard in the worst yeah. way. I mean, it would have been great if they had him for the first couple games when they got their butts kicked because Cameron Payne is not good.
He actually scored okay better, in that game against the Pistons, but they need someone who can yeah. defend.
Oh, one other thing before God. We get to the questions. As friend of the podcast, Stefan Noe pointed out in their loss to Detroit, Fred Hoiberg, in a tie game with like 13 seconds to go, has Jabari Parker on the floor in a defense-only possession, and the Pistons run a double high screen and then basically give Ish Smith the choice of where to attack. Surprise, surprise, he attacks Jabari Parker, and surprise, surprise, he gets right to the rim, gets a layup, they win the game.
Yeah, and Hoiberg's reason after the game was, well, I wanted to stick with the group that got us back in the game, and I've always never really cared for that logic that much. I mean, and especially in the last possession of the game where you're really matching up, they've called a timeout, they know exactly where they're going. You know, I don't really care for that. Also, it's rare that I will dispense fantasy advice, but any power forward who has any kind of ball skills going against the Bulls, being guarded by either Bobby Portis or Jabari Parker, and, you know, not a ton of help defense on that team either. You know, I mean, just watching like what Ben Simmons and Blake Griffin had 33 as his high as a Piston, just completely destroying the Bulls on Saturday night. So there you go. A little free daily fantasy advice for you there. DraftKings.com, by the way, use that cap space code. All right, here's the question. I'll let you start off here. What do you guys see as the optimal situation fit-wise for the Bulls front court long-term? Can Lowry and Carter play together all the time, or should they be staggered more?
I like the fit of those two guys. Yeah? I mean, it'll depend on how well they play, but in terms of fit, I have no problem with those two guys being penciled in as the front court of the future. And Carter's defense can work well. I mean, I still want to see more of Markin as a switch guy. He did show more athleticism last year than I expected from him, and you could do a couple of different things defensively, but it's also going to depend on who you get at the three. I mean, Zach LaVine is not a good switch guy, so there are lots of problems there, and they're paying him $76 million, I believe it is.
Hey, he's been really good offensively. Like, if he plays like this all year, we're going to look like idiots for saying that was a bad contract.
Right. Yeah. If he keeps being, even with his defensive foibles, if he's this good offensively, not a problem.
Yeah, I like the.
Do you disagree with me at all in the fit of Markkanen and Carter?
I think those guys, that was the excitement of drafting Carter. I think those are both pretty intelligent guys, some guys who've shown some ability to switch. And offensively, they can both shoot the ball. We haven't seen much of the three ball yet from Carter. You know, he's been more kind of handling the ball, doing DHOs, but Carter can pass pretty well too. He can make decisions on short rolls, you know, throw it to the weak side to Markkanen, and then space it out if they want to post up. Markkanen as well. Carter can also attack switches. So I think those guys are, if I had to pick someone to be a good fit next to Markkanen, I mean, maybe you could say, you know, a Clint Capella type who could switch, block shots, you know, ton of gravity at the rim, that sort of thing. But, you know, I really like Carter. I mean, those are both guys who are pretty versatile players. And so therefore it's easy to fit them together.
So now just draft the best player available on the perimeter for as long as you can, as long as you have to, basically.
Will the Bulls be last in defensive rating? We got about 2.5 minutes left here.
Oh, I don't think we need 2.5 minutes. Probably.
Oh, no, but there's so many other candidates, though, Danny.
There are other candidates. And it's true. I think what could end up happening is that they're really at the bottom, and then a team that tanks harder than they do just completely blows it up.
I think they have a 1 in 5 chance, because there's just like, there's so many other ones that are going to be really rough. Like, you know, Phoenix, I'm sure, is going to be down there. You know, certainly the Kings will be down there. The Cavaliers absolutely will be heard from by the end of this. The Hawks.
Oh, we're going to be talking about their defense very soon.
The Hawks will be heard from before this. I mean, it's pretty amazing too that like the average defense right now, and the defensive ratings are a little bit higher on NBA.com now because they're doing actual possession counts instead of estimates, which always underestimated the number of possessions by a couple of games, but nonetheless, you know, the median defensive rating right now is Orlando Magic with 110.5. And that's like just about the worst in the league last year. I mean, the offense is up, up, up. And part of that's because of fouling and these fouls happening on the perimeter, kind of in non-scoring situations that aren't really rewarding, you know, offensive attacks that are just turning blah possessions into free throws or getting teams in the bonus earlier. But, you know, a lot of it too is just this very offensive environment and teams are just, you know, playing smaller. When you play smaller, you're gonna generally defend worse and score better, and teams are taking more threes and they're running more, and pretty crazy to think about. But yeah, there are still some real bad teams that are going to be heard from here. I mean, I think I would put the bottom tier as the Cavs, Bulls, Kings, Suns, Hawks, and maybe you could throw the Mavs in there, although I think they'll ultimately get better. Carlisle is just too good of a coach, even if they don't have a ton of great defensive personnel.
Do we have more time?
I think we're good. We got like 30 seconds left. Let's move on.
Oh, well, can I make one quick joke? They said, who are the Bulls target in free agency next year? And so I was thinking of Chicago-born free agents. And so Amon Shumpert was on that list.
Yeah. Oak Park.
Derrick Rose.
Forest High School. The one alum of my high school who's in the NBA. Hey, D. Rose actually had a pretty damn good game against the Mavs the other day. All right. Cleveland now 0-3 as we record this. Which player would return the most assets in a trade once the Cavs start tanking? And I love the formulation of the question because they're already 0-3. 8 minutes on the clock here. Let's go through that, and then I'll talk a little bit about some of my observations from the game against the Hawks, which probably not going to be very good because they gave up $133 to a pretty under-talented team.
I would ask you a clarification question before we start with this. Would you count the young guys like Colin Sexton? Because I don't think Colin Sexton
players
would return.
Who realistically could be traded. Like Larry Nance is not going to get traded. He's got the base year compensation issues anyway. Once you sign a rookie extension, it's very difficult to trade someone unless it's into cap space, because you count for the average of this year's salary and then the value of the extension as incoming salary for the other team. But as outgoing salary, you only count as your salary for that year, which is really low. So it's very hard to make a trade with someone who's just signed a rookie extension. So Nance, Sexton, you know, we'll leave those guys out of it. Jetty Osmond will probably leave out of it. Everyone else, though, fire it up.
So what's striking here is how many of these players are negative value. So George Hill this year at $19 million, then he has a partial guarantee for $1 million next year. So he's basically an expiring contract. Tristan Thompson, $17.5 million this year, $18.5 million next year. J.R. Smith, $14.7 million this year, partial guarantee of $3.9 million. 9 next year. Kyle Korver, 7.6 this year, partial guarantee either 7.5 or 3.4 next year. Jordan Clarkson, 12.5, 13.4. All those people who said that we were wrong on Jordan Clarkson, I want to hear them.
Well,
now.
No, actually, anyway, I mean, he's been scoring pretty well so far this year. He might be.
He's been scoring well, but yeah. he's still a negative value on that
contract.
Yeah,
no, that's true.
And so then that's the question, is basically bringing those guys in. So for me, I think Kyle Korver's probably, depending on the circumstance, he's probably maybe a slight, you know, he's around there. I think there are teams that could make use of him. It's not the Cleveland Cavaliers at the moment, but I would say he's the most desirable of that group because he doesn't have a big outlay for next year, wouldn't come at a cost. And he's a little bit older, which I actually think kind of works because then you're not planning on him being a part of your long-term core. You could just fit him in right now.
Yeah. Interestingly, and I agree with you there.
Can I make a note? Oh, yeah. How ridiculous is it how far he's fallen that Tristan Thompson isn't number one
on
this list?
That was one of the observations I had from this game, is that his defense just is not where it used to be. He had that calf injury last year. Some would say it's the Kardashian curse, but whatever it is, he is not the same mobility that he was defensively, you know, back when he was playing defense in the 2016 finals, even 2017 in the playoffs. He did have a good defensive series against Al Horford in the conference finals, but I mean, he was getting blown by Torian Prince, blown by Trae Young, really just was not. And if he's not able to be switchable defensively, he really has like very, very little value. I mean, also interesting that in this game, both Kyle Korver and J.R. Smith, neither was on the injury list. It's not like they're on a back-to-back being rested. Neither of those guys even played. They started with Osman and Rodney Hood on the wing, Love, George Hill. So, I mean, it's really, you'd think they might want to try and like get his trade value up a little bit. He'll probably start playing once they realize they're totally out. But I mean, it's very difficult for me to believe that like Kyle Korver isn't one of the 10 best players on this team. You know, so maybe they're just acknowledging more already that this is kind of a developmental season, and just not playing Smith or Korver. Maybe Smith will be a buyout candidate. He's owed a small amount.
Well, and also Sam Decker being in the rotation because they have match rights on him after this year, but it's not like they have him on some sort of value contract beyond this. So evaluating him, giving him regular rotation minutes is another kind of
thing. I mean, now, if I were running the Cavs, I'd probably be doing the same thing because I've realized this is a completely lost year and they got to keep that top 10 protected pick, but they're ostensibly trying to win this year. Based on the game today, unlikely that they are going to be doing that. I did think their offense had some moments in the first half. They had a lot of nice back cuts, although ultimately, especially once the Hawks started switching a little bit more, you know, they weren't really able to get the assists going. It looked like Kevin Love was going to be on his way to a monster game, and they kind of really got away from giving him the ball, even with LeBron and Kyrie not there anymore. But, you know, they still have plenty of guards on this team who want to take plenty of ball hog shots and not give Kevin Love the ball. But Love is, for a lot of teams, especially a team that doesn't really have a four like the Hawks, is very difficult to defend. They're doing a lot of that same action, which is still very difficult to stop. We saw it in the playoffs last year. Kevin Love starting in the corner, the smallest guy on the floor, or whoever's being guarded by the smallest guy on the floor, goes to screen him out of the corner. The ball's at the elbow, and he can either get a back screen, go get a post up if you switch it, or if you try to shoot the gap, then he can step back for a three. So, and he's... I was trying to think of other players that it might be interesting to run that for, and there really aren't very many power forwards. Carl Anthony Towns actually would be a fascinating one to run that play with, but you know, the Wolves just don't really have enough spacing to do that, or enough creativity, frankly. But it's a very, very difficult play to stop, because if you have a guy who can both shoot the three stepping back behind a screen and has post-up ability as well. Jetty Osman looks very comfortable from downtown. That was one of the big questions for him, but he's also still pretty skinny. Guys who are not even like really strong guys, like, you know, a Torian Prince, are just going right through him, even when he has position defensively. I mentioned Thompson's defense, and just the Cavs D overall, it's not any better than it was. You know, people were actually saying, oh, maybe with LeBron gone, it'll be better, which, you know, because he was the leader and because he was giving so little effort last year, you thought maybe there could be some truth to that maybe just like getting him out of their defensive culture could help. But no, I mean, pretty much like they tried everything. It was just as haphazard as it always was with LeBron there. You know, they'd switch, they didn't know that they were switching, they don't have the personnel to switch when Love is out there, and they can't take Love off the floor now the way they used to sometimes. And they got nobody to protect the rim. Larry Nance, to me, did not look good as well. Like, he's got only really one that I can remember. He had like a pretty nasty dunk like right away when he first got over, and then he had that hamstring injury. We haven't seen these wow plays from him that we used to see when he was with the Lakers. He's not really a shot blocker. He's not really a switch guy either. You know, we've talked about why we didn't think that was a great contract. He was questionable for today's game with the sprained ankle, so maybe he was a little limited, but that's another issue for him is health. He's got a lot of nagging injuries in his career.
Well, and Nance did hit two, off the top of my head, I remember, two long twos in this game, but A, they're long twos, not threes, and B, that's not enough for the defense to really care about it.
Yeah.
You know, it's a shot that you're willing
to
live with.
In today's game, the long two is even worse than it always has been because there's such a high offense environment. You're giving up a chance at a much better shot. All right, we're good with that. Let's move on to the Detroit Pistons, who I must admit I have not seen a full game of theirs yet. But I think this is an interesting question. Is healthy Blake Griffin an all-star this season?
I mean, I think there's a chance of it. It's, you know, being in the East as opposed to being in the West opens it up a little bit, but there's still a lot of talent on the forward line. I mean, he's sure as heck not going to start. I mean, they have, you have Kawhi and you have all of the Celtics guys, you know, the Celtics guys, you have so, Giannis is obviously going to start. He'll probably be the leading East front court vote getter, but it's not so deep that I think, you know, and he's going to probably have a lot of usage. So, my instinct is no, but I do think there's a respectable shot.
Yeah, I mean, you'd have to say, especially, we'll see how good the Pistons are, right? I mean, and the Pistons, people forget, were actually pretty respectable last year. And then, of course, as soon as Reggie Jackson goes down, they completely fall apart again. And so if they start off pretty well and, you know, they're over 500 by a little bit and they're in the playoff mix and they're looking like the sixth seed or something, or the seventh seed, then I think it looks a lot better for them. If they're not in the playoffs, you know, I don't see it. I mean, a lot of it is, you know, how much are the coaches going to say, okay, someone like Ben Simmons or Jason Tatum, Gordon Hayward coming back from his injury, probably isn't going to have played enough minutes by then. He doesn't seem on track, but maybe, you know, how many of these guys who are younger versus Blake Griffin, who, you know, has never been particularly well liked, but is still, you know, more established, a bigger name than some of those guys. Who else is he in competition with at four? You know, maybe if the Bucks are doing really well, Chris Middleton could be in the mix for one of those front court spots.
Well, Kevin Love would be an interesting one to be in.
He is a very interesting analog there. You know, obviously Embiid, he'll probably be the starting center again, you would imagine. Kawhi will be in there. I don't think the Raptors will have any other potential candidates in the front court. So I think he'll be right on the borderline. I think he's going to be in competition with Hayward, Tatum, Simmons, and Love. Like, those are the guys he's going to be competing with. And I think, you know, depending on what happens with those teams and, you know, potential injuries, you know, those could go either way. But I'd put him, you know, maybe third out of four in that pecking order right now. You know, I think the league has just kind of passed him by and Detroit is just sort of this backwater. Oh, and his teammate Andre Drummond is another one who could be in the mix there also.
Those guys might be competing for one spot. It's entirely possible that it'll go in that direction. And all this, I'm not going to make this point very often. Even
oh, Al Horford,
about it,
too.
But
Al Horford.
All-star roster should be...
Yeah, so with all those guys,
all-star roster should
I
be
think
15.
It's probably more likely than not he doesn't make it, unless there are injuries. But they did say he's healthy, and odds are at least one of those guys is going to be injured, so that helps him. But I'm going to say probably not. I'm going to say he probably doesn't make it.
Yeah, I would expect that he does not. Somebody asked if the Pistons can finish above average. I'm going to assume that's above 500. Yeah, they absolutely can. I mean, they have enough talent to beat the bad teams, and then they can compete against the mid-tier. I think they'll get worked a lot by the best teams just because they don't have enough offensive firepower, and they're not super hard to defend, so they'll probably have to do their damage in the bottom half of the league. But can they? Yes. Will they? I think I said they would win 37, and that's about where I still expect them to be.
Yeah, I had them pick for 36 this year. Their over under I think it was 39 though, so, and hey, they started 2-0. Those wins are in the bank at least here. All right, we got one more here before we got to take this to a part two, and that is the Indiana Pacers, who are 2-1 as of this discussion. You wanted to introduce a feature you're going to be tracking all year here for the Pacers.
Yeah, I'm not going to give the numbers through three games for this year, but I'm going to, like, so I did this last year. I picked a couple of things at the beginning of the year. Like, there was one with DeMarcus Cousins and AD, which sadly we only got for half the year. But I want to track Victor Oladipo's proportion of shots and success on three different categories. And so pull-up threes last year, they were 17% of his shots, and he made about 36% of those. So that meant that it was 1.068 points per shot attempt. So that's, you know, that's good. Catch and shoot threes, 16.6% of his attempts, 39.4 field goal percentage. So that's a 1.18 points per attempt, which is great. And then on pull-up twos, I didn't realize it was as high as it was. 30.3% of his shots last year, and shooting 44% on those meant 0.886, so less than a point per attempt on those shots. So I'm going to keep track of the proportion and the success rate of those over the course of the year, because I think that's going to do a lot to define, to figure out what he is. And he's still a really, really good player either way, but I want to see how those elements change over this year.
Yeah, and it would be interesting to see too how much he benefits from Tyreke Evans, who looked awesome actually in that win over the Nets on Saturday night. Like, some of the Euro steps that he was doing in transition were looking like unstoppable. Really looked good. But you know, having one more ball handler in the game, maybe he can take away a few of those long twos. Interestingly enough, you know, Indiana, I mean, he was 44%. That's an awesome percentage for mid-range, but Indiana took a ton of long twos last year and made a ton of long twos last year. And so, you know, you could say, hey, maybe you should take a few of those shots. You know, it's good for him to take more threes, and that's true to some extent, but you know, still somebody has to take the long twos on a team in general. And so if you have someone who can make 44% of those, that's actually like not bad, you know. So I don't think it's the end of the world that he's taking that. All right, we got about 6 minutes left here. So one of the questions we had is, how much do you expect the Pacers to benefit from roster continuity?
I think of that really mattering for about the first month of the season, and it will really help them because their starting five is exactly the same and those guys fit together well. They also played some of their best basketball at the end of last year, you know, in that playoff run when they took the Cavs to 7 games. And they did turn over their bench, but I think the way that their bench turned over actually works better, maybe because you can use Tyreke Evans in a lot of ways. He's also an upgrade off of what they had before. So I think continuity will really help them because they know where everybody knows where their teammates want the ball and all that kind of stuff. How much of a benefit will that be? You know, maybe a win or two over the first month of the season.
Yeah, and they are working in Tyreke, who's one of the primary ball handlers, and Jay Michael, who's just doing great work for the Indy Star, is talking about how Tyreke is not quite there as far as what McMillan wants him to do on either end, but he has actually been impressed with Tyreke's effort defensively, which is, you know, the more important thing. They also, you know, Sabonis has been out for a couple of games, and he's one of their best kind of feel guys who can take advantage of some of those continuity sort of plays as that short roll man, as a passer in the DHO game. Another question here, should Indiana be looking to play Sabonis and Turner together? I don't believe so. I think we've been pretty adamant about that. Both of those guys are centers. Sabonis really, you know, he was a rookie, but his three ball is not there yet. You know, he made like his first like 40% through like his first like 15 attempts in OKC, and he's never really made threes since then. And so he's really a center, certainly offensively. Turner is definitely a center. So, you know, it's having one of those guys just essentially have to space out to three is not the best use of their talents. And then defensively is the greater issue. Neither of them can guard the four position. You can understand the thought of like, well, you know, Sabonis can't really protect the rim, so we'll leave Turner in there. And then, you know, it probably works a little better offensively where Turner can just space it out, but defensively is where it really falls apart. And they got plenty of good options at the fourth. Thaddeus Young is an excellent defensive four, and then they've got some guys who can pop up to play the four for, you know, at least offensively, in either McDermott or Bogdanovic. Those guys have played a small ball four before. TJ Leaf actually is having an okay start to the season before and preseason before injuring his ankle. He's questionable for tomorrow, but yeah. And Nate McMillan has said as much. He said, no, we don't believe that combination works very well. They played it plenty last year. It was by far the least effective of their big man combinations. They were in the negative when Sabonis and Young and Turner and Young both were really positive combinations for them. So I see little reason to try it. Now, the fact that those two guys can't play together is maybe a little bit of an indictment of giving Miles Turner the extension now instead of waiting to kind of see how it all plays out and seeing if they could get him for cheaper in free agency, or just letting him go if he got too much, or, you know, seeing what his performance was over this year. You know, he hasn't looked amazing so far. He's lost so much weight, blah, blah. But, you know, we haven't really seen that on the court yet in the preseason or so far this year. But, you know, that was a long rambling answer to that.
Well, It's actually even more stark than I remember. They were outscored by 8.8 points per 100 possessions last year with those guys. So that's one of their worst lineup pairings of all. And when you consider the talent of those two guys. And also, I would mention, I don't like Sabonis and Kyle O'Quinn playing together that much either for similar reasons, because O'Quinn doesn't space the floor as well as Miles Turner.
Yeah, so that's an even worse combination.
Yeah, I mean... Mm-hmm.
Yeah, that's why. I mean, yeah.
So I wish they had one more forward. I mean, I understand having O'Quinn on the roster if he's available for that room mid level because you have it. Because in case one of those two guys gets hurt, then you can slide the other guy up and just have O'Quinn fill in the backup role. But I wish they had one more forward. It would really, really help them.
Another question here. How would you rank the Pacers bench compared to the rest of the league? It's pretty good. They got very good backups at four of the five positions. The one exception being power forward, where they don't really have an established backup. Leaf, who was really bad last year. I'm not going to say he's going to be good this year because he's looked slightly better so far. And certainly defensively, I'm not buying him at all. But I mean, to really go nine deep with very good legitimate rotation players. And, you know, you've got Evans, who probably, you know, could start for a lot of teams. McDermott is a fine backup. Sabonis is a very good quality backup center. Corey Joseph, you know, is close to a starting level of player, you know, if a very bad starter, but you know, he's in the top 40 point guards in the league probably. So no, I think they have pretty good depth. Maybe at the one and the three, it's more concerning that they just don't have that good of a starter at those positions. But you know, maybe Evans will close games at the three or at the one, and they can get by that way. So I think it's one of the best ones. I mean, it's not the Celtics, it's not the Clippers, it's not Miami. Although Evans gives them so much scoring punch that, you know, they're in pretty good shape there. So they're probably, you know, in the top five of the league, I would say.
One other one I'd add in at the top is the Raptors.
Yes.
I mean,
yes.
They have a lot of dudes. Yes. Yeah, that was part of why that Toronto-Boston game was so much fun, is because the quality of play never dipped, and it was a blast.
Yeah, that really was a fantastic early season basketball. All right, we are about done here for today, but we'll finish up at the East with a part two. We wanted to have enough time to really get into all these great questions that we got on Twitter. So thanks for listening, and we'll be back tomorrow. Talk to you all then. Navy Federal has a mission to put members first by making their financial goals the priority. Receive a lifetime of membership benefits to help you and your family accomplish your life missions, like a full suite of financial products designed to fit your needs, 24/7 live support, and access to over 300 branches on or near military bases. Visit NavyFederal.org for more information. Call 1-888-842-6328 or download the Navy Federal Credit Union app. Message and data rates may apply.
You must love hoops if you're enjoying another great episode of Dunked On. The Locked On Podcast Network has more hoops for you. Locked On has a podcast on every NBA team. If you're a Lakers fan, a Bucks fan, a Celtics fan, or a Mavericks fan, the Locked On Podcast Network has a daily podcast on your favorite team. All 30 NBA teams have a daily podcast at Locked On. Search on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts for Locked On, your favorite team, or tell your smart speaker to play podcast Locked On, your favorite team. Locked On Podcast Network, your team every day.